Moncrief on News Talk.
Life's too short not to spend it with the person that you love. I want to be with you always, no matter what. I just can't imagine my life without you.
Me either. Belly has always been our story, yours and mine, nobody else's.
That's The Summer I Turned Pretty. New episodes of season 3 every Wednesday on Amazon Prime Video. James Dempsey joins us once again. Good afternoon, James.
Afternoon.
Is this the same characters, or do they kind of, with each season, have a different set of characters?
No, it's the same. It's following the same core group.
You think she'd be pretty at this age of the game? Did she get zits in season 2 or something?
It is a funny one, right? So this is based on a series of books by Jenny Han. She's probably best known to me anyway as also the writer of To All the Boys I Loved Before, which was like a Netflix kind of mini series that launched the career of a few people. And this is something that had very good kind of critical appraisal in its first season. And now that its final season has come around and it is summer and I have to plumb the depths of limited options.
Okay.
I thought the time is ripe for me to give it a go. And I find it compellingly boring melodrama, right?
Okay.
So it essentially involves a love triangle in which our heroine, Lola Tung is her name. She plays Belly, Isabel Belly Conklin. She and her mother and brother spend every summer at this sort of like cape in Massachusetts with the mother's college friend and her two hunky sons, right?
Okay, yeah.
So the love triangle comes between Belly and the two sons, being Conrad and Jeremiah. They're played by Christopher Briney and Gavin Casaleño. And this is like, if you're looking for Euphoria-esque teen antics, if that's, you know, cheese, this is the chalk, because this this is absolutely not that.
Okay.
The first season is sort of about them, you know, having this wonderful life. I was talking to my friend about it and she was like, yeah, lovely hydrangeas. And that is sort of how I would describe it, right? It's a show about beautiful hydrangeas. It's set in lovely houses on a Massachusetts cape with, you know, that kind of like nautical boat wearing shoe, you know, boat shoe polo shirt.
Yeah. And you're pausing it to look at, ooh, what's that? I like that tape, that mantelpiece there.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then the most chaste love triangle you've ever seen in your life, right? Mm. But it is a huge, massive hit. Now, I will say it is a hit with people aged between, women aged between 18 and 34. And those are brackets that I no longer exist within. So I absolutely admit that this is not made for me.
Yeah.
But like, it's something I was willing to give a go.
Mm.
Now, the first season is like as PG as you get. I mean, we're talking a few kisses and awkward glances and will they, won't they, are they, are, what's going on now? The second season takes quite a big turn. It's based on three novels, so that's why we're getting three seasons. The second season is sort of all about the house in this fictional, I think it's a fictional town of cousins. And then this third season, which has just started, also jumps forward in time. And now we have Belly at college and coming to terms with her life and what she's going to do with the rest of her life. Meanwhile, the love triangle is a bit stretched out in the way that it hadn't previously been, but it still exists. Now, it is an odd show for me because it is so, it's like so boring. it reminds me a lot of Heartbreaker, the Heartstopper, sorry, the Netflix LGBTQI romance, which is so earnestly chaste in its romance that, like, I honestly heard someone say if it was about straight people, it would be the most boring show on TV.
Yeah.
And here that is, right? Yeah. So I find it very, very, like, not like, my main issue with it is it's a love triangle built around this character Belly, who I find utterly banal and milquetoast. You know, the only kind of interesting thing about her is that she gets competitive when she plays volleyball. But other than that, they talk about how she's not the clever one in the family. She's the shy one. You know, she had a pair of glasses until she turned pretty and took them off at 16. And now suddenly they notice that she's a 6 foot tall model. Right? Yeah. In the first season, they see her taking part at a debutante ball, which was not actually in the original novel. They just thought it would add a bit more heft to the season. And a lot of the first season is also about the kind of, but the friendship between her mother, Laurel, who's a novelist, a kind of middle of the road novelist, and the friend who is the owner of the house and the mother of the two sons, who is dying of cancer.
Okay.
To add yet another seam of absolute melodrama into it. Now, it moves on, and I won't go into spoiler territory for anyone who is going to wet their toe in The Summer I Turned Pretty. But, like, I can see this, you know, this is a huge hit globally. It amongst the demographic of women aged 18 to 34, it is the second most watched show on Amazon worldwide.
Wow.
It also saw the three books after the first season was released, you know, head straight to the top of the bestseller ranks on Amazon. So that is another kind of advantage you know, our in-house shop system has. And another thing that I don't know if other viewers have, or people, if you have Amazon Prime Video, have noticed is that surprisingly, the kind of three areas that they are going for, or maybe four, right? So they've got kind of superheroes that curse. Then they have crime and detective-y type stuff. They have an awful lot of teen stuff, right? Like, as in, there's a few other kind of teen YA stuff that they have launched in recent months. And I find this kind of intriguing because, first of all, teen audiences are not paying the bill for Amazon. Obviously, parents are paying that bill. And I don't know if teens are sitting down to watch these shows, and are they building them, designing them specifically for adult audiences to, I don't know, have a bit of a nostalgia hit of their teenage years in the summertime. But look, if you want to look at beautiful houses and beautiful hydrangeas, this cannot be beaten. It is unparalleled. It is easy escapism. I mean, the fact that they're still stretching out the love triangle three seasons in seems a little incredulous to me. I'm not particularly interested in watching the, you know, very will they won't they romances of 16 year olds in high school, and that is what it's serving. So it's not for me, but I can understand how it has beautiful pastel colors, it has a really good soundtrack, they play a lot of Taylor Swift if that's your thing, and certainly it has for people of my generation, enviable house imagery going on.
No, excellent. And so, but like your woman Belly, how old is she now? She's in college
now, she's about 20.
Okay, and the two lads, so the two lads have been like knocking Tara out of each other for her affections for the
last
4 years.
Of them gains the upper hand for a long time, but then in the third season, all changes. Everything changes.
Oh, really? What a surprise. who knew? Okay, yeah. Yeah, I suppose it's kind of a vibes thing rather than it's a plot thing.
It's a vibes, 100%. I guess, like, I mean, so many YA series are based on a love triangle formula, right?
Yeah,
it is a known thing that works because you have Team X, Team Y, and then let's get X and Y together and see what happens. I mean, but the problem is here they're brothers. So it adds an extra layer of familial oddness to the love triangle.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So quite a distance from what we've just been talking about. Our next show is One Night in Idaho, The College Murders. You can stream the entire series now on Amazon Prime Video. Here's a clip.
And my phone started to ring, and it was Hunter's voice. He just said, "Ethan's not here." That's what he said. He goes, "Ethan's not here." And I'm like, "Well, go get him." And he just kept repeating it. Like, "They're not, no, you don't understand what I'm telling you, Mom. They're not here. Ethan and Zanna are not here." And I'm like, "Well, go and get them."
Like, I couldn't face the fact that he was dead.
He's like, "No," I think he said to me, he goes, "Mom, you don't understand. They're not on this earth anymore," I believe is what he said to me.
Whoa. Okay, then. Very strange case altogether. Yeah. So is this case done and dusted? Everyone's been sent to prison and all that kind of stuff? So
yeah. So first of all, to use a kind of crass terminology, it's a more satisfying true crime documentary because everything gets tied up, right?
Yes.
As in, a lot of times in true crime documentaries, there's a lot of speculation and raised questions without any possible answers. And what's interesting about this one is that while they were making it, and it's made by Liz Garbus, who is a very highly respected documentarian and having a very prolific year because she's made so many things this year. while they were making it, there was a gag order on reporting on the case in the US because they really wanted to absolutely nail all the evidence down and make sure that the culprit did not get away with it. His name is Brian Koberger, and he just pled guilty in order to avoid the death sentence. And in Idaho, they've actually just changed the death sentence to firing squad. So
okay,
you can understand why that would happen. So one evening in 2022, he broke into a house and murdered four college students at the University of Idaho. He stabbed them to death. And basically, this documentary follows the impact that this murder and the case itself has had on their families. Not all of them are involved, I should say, and their friends. And their friends are the ones who ultimately discovered them inside the house the following morning. And it's a really interesting piece of true crime documentary. Like, you know, as much as you can say, it is the gold standard of true crime documentary making, in my opinion, because it doesn't really focus on the murderer. So it doesn't really glamorize or sensationalize anything. But it goes very in depth into the impact that such a lurid and violent and unexpected crime would have on a very, very small community, and how those ramifications lead on for the rest of your life. And I was reviewing a true crime documentary last week about, you know, this woman on who may have fallen off a cruise ship or not. We don't know what happened. And I said, like, oh, you know, there were these threads that they had not explored. And these are, and those exact threads are explored in great detail here. Perhaps the most interesting one for us viewers, because, I mean, we are complicit in it as well, right? Consuming a piece of media about this terrible true crime, is they go to great lengths to explore the online sleuths that really took this case, you know, were incredibly struck by the oddness and bizarreness of this case and would be posting constantly on social media theories and suggestions, and how if you were, you know, a friend of these murdered four, their four names are Ethan Chapin, Kaylee Goncalves, Zana Kernodle and Madison Hogan. If you were one of their friends, imagine that you are going on to TikTok to, you know, pass your time and suddenly you're seeing over and over and over again suspicions that you were somehow involved in this, even though you just, you were the person who discovered your friend's murdered body. And it talks about how there was an online Facebook group that had maybe 100,000 members exploring it, and how the murderer himself was on this Facebook group throwing out red herrings to get people off his case. It's a really interesting and modern, you know, interpretation of a true crime drama, while also really fleshing out the lives of these young people. Like, I had heard of the case because the murderer had pled guilty earlier in June, and then there was a rush to get out these documentaries. So there's a few competing documentaries about it. This is the better one of them. The other one is on Peacock in the US and online, let's say, in Ireland. And this one is just much more thoughtfully made. It has interviews with family members and friends and direct witnesses of various parts of this crime, whereas the other one is interviews with investigators and lawyers and stuff. So the fact here is that a good name is attached to it, right? Like a name of someone, Liz Garbus, I should say, and also Matthew Galkin. I'm less familiar with his stuff, but Liz Garbus has a really excellent track record of making interesting, introspective, well-made, entertaining documentaries. And this is another one included in that, about a very sad, tragic case, but a gold standard look at how to tell that story.
Is it a spoiler to say what his motive was?
Not really, because the crime in itself, because it's not really about the crime, right? I mean, of course it's about the crime, but it's not, it's more about the impact of the crime than the crime itself. So he was a PhD candidate in criminology and was just, as far as we can tell, obsessed with crime and serial killers and I suppose performing the perfect crime. And they have interviews with classmates of him, of his, from when he was doing his undergraduate degree in criminology, and they would talk about how he was a brilliant student, but he was an odd person. And it explains, you know, what he did and how he went about doing it without going into lurid details.
Yeah.
And it ends ultimately, you know, with the university knocking down the house. It's this off-campus house where the students were murdered, because it was just this constant reminder everyone. So it is just a very, very well, it, you know, it is the best possible version of this kind of documentary, and a reminder that true crime, while lurid and sensationalizing at times, can also be very, very impactful and moving.
Yeah, indeed. But I assume this guy's perfect crime wasn't that perfect. No. They arrested him pretty quickly.
He left something behind on the scene.
Yeah. Okay. Rookie mistake. Right. Our next show is called Building the Band. You can stream the entire first season now on Netflix. Here's a clip.
Where do you see yourself in the girl group? Like, are you the mother of the group? Are you the leader?
When I originally was coming into the competition, I definitely saw myself as the front of a band.
Yep.
I definitely am very comfortable taking leadership. My thing that I always say is what I desire already belongs to me.
There you go. That's Building the Band. So I suppose the best way to describe this is it's a bit like this and a bit like that, yeah. I suppose.
So it's a bit like The Voice
meets,
bizarrely, of all things, Love is Blind. Right?
Okay.
So Love and you know, so The Voice is, you know, they have the four judges have their backs turned to you. They push a button when they decide your voice is so good that I'm going to spin my chair around.
Yeah.
And everyone on The Voice is generally good. There's nobody terrible on The Voice, right? And then Love is Blind has people in pods blindly talking to each other. So the mechanism of this one is that we have 50 singers and they perform to, one singer performs to the other 49 who are sitting in pods and they can only hear the singer's voice.
Yeah.
And they have the ability to push a button up to a maximum of 10 times if they like your voice.
Okay.
And then, one, like, let's say I as a singer get 18 button pushes. I can then start chatting to those 18 people in the hope that we can form one of the six bands that can come out of round one. And the bands can either be all boys, all girls, or mixed genders, and they must be a minimum of three people and a maximum of five, I think, right?
Okay.
So then it begins this social aspect of, well, are you? Do you want to be in a band? Do you want to be in a girl band? Do you want to be in a mixed group? Now, that's actually not that interesting, right? Yeah. Like, they really...
Really? You shocked me with our revelation.
They really sell off this, like, oh, there's going to be this, like, social aspect of the game that absolutely goes nowhere. Now, again, like, the problem with a show like this is, obviously, the X Factor and its ilk had its day in prime time. I mean, they were absolutely massive, God, 15 years ago, right? Sunday night TV at its finest, you know, and they built a narrative across weeks. Right, as in you had your rehearsals where they, of course, had terrible people that we embarrassed publicly, but that was part of the fun. Mm. And then we had like judges' houses and then, you know, whittle them down to being mentored, quote unquote, whatever that meant, by the judges, the live performances and build up to Christmas number one.
Yeah.
But it was a probably 3 month long process that, you know, built up a narrative. Whereas with streaming, you just have all the episodes at once, right? Yeah. And the other thing here is they're building bands with no connection to each other except for having listened to each other sing once.
Yeah.
So what you get is a lot of people going, that is amazing. Our voices sound great together. But that is the only, like, that's the only kind of selling point that each person has. So it's incredibly repetitive. And then when they finally form the bands and they move on to a kind of like live performance style thing in front of judges, I mean, then it's just an elimination type thing. But but there's no live peril to it for us viewers because it's all pre-recorded. Now, it has been delayed in its release. And the reason for that is because one of the judges is the late Liam Payne, right? So this was filmed all last year. And I presume they've been just waiting till for an appropriate mourning period in which to release it. And it is, I suppose, it stands as a testament to him as a music personality that this is his swan song appearance. But all in, I just don't know if this kind of music reality competition has a space in this era of streaming. Because I just feel the whole point of, you know, the enjoyment I got out of The X Factor was this kind of week in, week out, we are following their journey to, you know, Christmas number one and then flop.
Yeah.
Right. But like, they didn't all flop, obviously. Some of the, I mean, Liam Payne came from One Direction and that came from The X Factor. Obviously, big household names have come from The X Factor, but I just don't know if that era exists anymore.
Yeah, it may well not. And is there a stage in the show where there's big performances in front of an audience and all that kind of big production value?
Yeah, so they moved to a studio in Manchester and they performed to a local audience there who probably all had to sign an NDA and not reveal any of it. So, you know, like all in, for me, the biggest flaw with the show is that it's taking soloists and forming them into a band, despite the fact that they have perhaps no interest in being in a band. That's just the mechanism of the show. You must form a band.
Yeah, but it's not really a band. It's a group of singers.
Yes, it's a group of singers.
Yeah, and then presumably they have to row about Because, you know, in all the boy band, there was really one person who did most of the singing. So they have to go through that stage where they row about who's actually at the front.
Well, they have to. So they get mentored and they have a vocal coach who kind of guides them. But they have to come up with how they're going to harmonize, who's going to take the lead on this part and that part. And, you know, the judges are saying to them constantly, well, you can't all be stars in the band. Like, somebody needs to be the Gary Barlow, right? Somebody needs to be Gary Barlow, Ronan Keating, somebody, right? And that's part of the peril as well, because we know that they're all good singers because we've seen them all rehearsing, because originally they weren't in a band. Yeah. They're just in a band for the sake of being in a band because that's the show.
And don't give away who wins it, because we'll all be dying to watch it. But what do they win if they win it, or what did they win?
The winners win a $500,000 record deal.
Okay.
Which goes a lot further than there's only three in your band.
That sounds good, actually. So the thing is, though, if the winners of this have won this $500,000 record deal, well, presumably they can't release anything yet. They have to wait until the massive success of whatever the name of that building the band is first. Yes. He says, consulting his notes. Right, okay, well, we look forward to that. Those three shows are The Summer I Turned Pretty, new episodes of Season 3 every Wednesday on Amazon Prime Video. One Night in Idaho, The College Murders. You can stream the entire series now on Amazon Prime Video. And Building the Band, you can stream the entire first season now on Netflix. James Dempsey, thanks a million.
Thank you.
You are listening to The Moncrief Show.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.